call the next case.
May it please the court, Helen Randolph for Mr. Winslow. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Right.
Your Honors, this is a single fingerprint case. We're asking the court to reverse the judgment of the trial court and order the case be dismissed with prejudice. Our argument is based on sufficiency. There is no evidence in the record supporting the timing of the fingerprint. Mr. Winslow's single fingerprint was found on the backside of a box that was found in the center console of a car. Both the box and the car are movable objects. The case law is very plain that a fingerprint on a movable object, which purportedly connects someone to a crime, has to be proven to have been placed at the time of the crime and at the place of the crime in order to be sufficient evidence. The Commonwealth simply has not proven that. The Commonwealth's own evidence shows that the fingerprint alone is insufficient to establish the time. At pages 106 and 107 of the appendix, the Commonwealth's fingerprint expert said, one, you cannot tell when a print is left, and two, prints can last a long time, depending on the surface they're on and what they're exposed to. That evidence proves that the print itself is not going to be enough to establish the time. Mr. Duncan's evidence proves that both the car and the box were accessible at lots of times other than the committing of the crime. The box was in the car. We don't know from the evidence how it sat in the car. We do know from the fact that five latent print cards were lifted from the prints taken from the back of the box, that a lot of fingerprints were put on the card. If you look at page 139 of the sealed appendix, you'll see there's a lot of prints on that one card. There were five cards taken by Officer Wood, so there are a lot of prints on the box as it sits in the car. The box was in the car, according to Mr. Duncan, for at least a year. That's all we know about where the box was before it was in the car, for at least a year. The case law talks a lot about the provenance and the history and location of where movable objects have been in asserting when the fingerprint was placed. The Commonwealth did not provide us a single piece of evidence with respect to where the box was before it was put in the car. They didn't ask Mr. Duncan, where'd you get the box? They didn't ask him if he wiped it off before he put it in the car. They didn't ask him if a fingerprint on the back is necessary in order to open the box. We know absolutely nothing other than one fingerprint on the back of the box, which has been in the car for at least a year. And the fingerprint expert says fingerprints can last a long time. So what this case basically comes down to is whether the Commonwealth has proven to us that at least a year is shorter than a long time. And it's the Commonwealth's burden to prove that. They haven't proven that. Your Honors, the cases that talk about fingerprints, many of them are where a fingerprint is placed on, say, a window or something where it's evident from the placement of the fingerprint that the person had to be at the location of the scene at some time or another. That's the Avent case, the Tyler case. Even in those cases, in the Barker case, a fingerprint was on, or a palm print, was on the side of a door jamb, but even that was not sufficient to prove when it was put there. In our case, it's even harder to prove when the fingerprint was put there. A lot of movable object cases are fingerprints on the exterior of a car. There are no fingerprints on the exterior of this car. The tech only took fingerprints from the box. No fingerprints from anything else. No fingerprints from the exterior of the car. No fingerprints from the buckle of the suitcase holding the laptops. No fingerprints from the inside of the box. No fingerprints from the console. No fingerprints any other place.
What about Rick's counsel? Wouldn't Rick's support the holding in this case?
No, Your Honor. Rick's talks about...
A fingerprint on a jar of things?
Yes. In that case, Your Honor, the fingerprints... In which they cited the cases of Boren and Stevenson, which are helpful and useful in this kind of analysis. And I'll refer you to Judge Bazelon's opinion in the Stevenson case. Boren and Stevenson were like Rick's in that there were fingerprints on ordinary objects found inside a house. And the cases were distinguished for reasons that are favorable to us. In one case, fingerprints were on an ordinary jar, and there was testimony from the expert that fingerprints could last indefinitely or for a period of years, and there was no history as to where the jars had been. In that case, the court said that's not enough. In Stevenson, in contrast, as in Rick's, the court had five other indicia to show why the fingerprints on things touched at the scene were sufficient to prove guilt. One, there were two different things touched by the defendant. Two, there were other things touched in the house by a co-defendant. Three, there was specific testimony that the things touched had been in the house for 5 years and 12 years and 3 years, respectively, and had never moved. Four, there was specific testimony from the government's expert that the prints might last as long as 2 years. So there was a lot of other evidence. In our case, we don't have any other evidence, and we have lots of evidence in our case that the box was accessible. Mr. Duncan acknowledges that he may have left it unlocked. The tech seems to think that the car was left unlocked. So on the night of the crime, the car was accessible to other people, including Mr. Winslow. He testified that his car was generally accessible to a lot of people. He valeted it. He parked it. He said that at page 61 of the joint appendix, the car was generally accessible to a lot of people I might not know about. So that car was accessible. That box could have received prints while it was on the car. Also,
the testimony that you just cited to me from Rick's 5 years, 3 years, 2 years, where is that?
No, that was from Stevenson.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That wasn't
okay,
from
Rick, okay.
So I apologize. That was from Stevenson. That was from Judge Bazelon's concurrence because it distinguishes those two cases. And that's important for our case because it emphasizes the fact that there are no other facts here.
But in Rick's, all they had was a jar of pennies. Rick saying, I've never been in the house, and then saying, well, yeah, I did go by the house and attempt to steal the pennies once before. The court disbelieved that. So all you have is a fingerprint on a jar of pennies in the house. Why is that any different?
Your Honor, that's not all you have. You had testimony that was disbelieved. You had a credibility issue with respect to the defendant. And you had his admission that he had been there before.
Which was the testimony that was disbelieved.
Yes. In our case, we don't have any issues with credibility. We don't have any reason to disbelieve the defense evidence, which there wasn't any of. So that's a positive in a sufficiency of evidence argument.
Maybe we're missing each other. If the court disbelieved his testimony that he had been in the house before, then what we are left with is that his fingerprint was on the jar in the house.
Yes, Your Honor. His fingerprint was on the jar in the house.
Okay.
And he had made some kind of statements or testimony that he was familiar with the house. And I believe in that case, the victim said that he had been in her house before. So that is very different from our case. First, it's a house. You have to go there to put the print on whatever's in there. So regardless of...
As I understand your argument in this case, the defendant could have touched this money jar at some time in the past. The victim purchased it and placed it in his car with the print on it. And so I don't see the distinction between that and Rick's. The defendant could have touched the money jar at some time in the past. The victim purchased the money jar with the print on it, brought it to her home, and with the print on it. and we affirmed Ricks. I'm missing the distinction.
Yes, Your Honor. I know that in Ricks, the court specifically distinguished forum and status. And in Ricks, Your Honor, there was, as I said, evidence, whether it was believed or not believed, from both the defendant and the victim, that he had been in their home, in the victim's home. And
so in Ricks, the court could reasonably come to the conclusion that the defendant had been in the victim's home, but that his stated time and but that his stated time for being in the home was a lie. I'm going to believe part of your testimony. Yeah, you were in their home. But I'm not going to believe you that you were in their home at some time other than when the crime was committed. I don't see how that... Ricks is still uncomfortably close to your fact pattern.
Your Honor, in Ricks, they say at the end, right before they are affirming it, that the case is distinguishable from Borum because there was no evidence that the fingerprint could have been on the jar indefinitely or for a period of years. In our case, the Commonwealth's evidence is that fingerprints last a long time, and you cannot tell.
But counsel, I think a reasonable inference to be drawn from this evidence is if this box is located in his car for more than a year, and he handles it multiple times a day, and they can only find a couple fingerprints that are able to be identified, one of them is the victim's and one's the defendant's, isn't it reasonable to conclude that the fingerprint was placed sometime within a recent period of time? Isn't that a reasonable inference to draw? And then you want us to go further and say, well, there's no evidence that the defendant didn't touch it some other time, either as a valet or prior to the box being put in the car. But what about the language in Avent where it says, while a defendant does not have the obligation to testify himself or to offer testimony to explain, a court cannot simply supply evidence that's lacking?
Your Honor, two things. Those are two very different questions. The second one, it is the Commonwealth's burden to prove when
Absolutely.
The fingerprint was placed.
But what about that language in Avent? They're saying the court doesn't have to come up with its own answer to questions that are reasonably answered by the Commonwealth's evidence.
Again, in Avent, unlike Ricks, the person really did have to go there. The fingerprint was on a window that was 7 feet off the street, and it was the entry point for the burglary. So that's totally distinguishable because the Commonwealth's evidence was that the person had to be there in order to...
Well, the facts are distinguishable, but the point is, it's not up to the Commonwealth to say, well, this is a not very conceivable answer, but here's why this answer doesn't work. Sam, my point is, you're posing what are fairly or less conceivable answers than the reasonable inference that the defendant's the one that put that fingerprint on there when he stole the money.
Your Honor, let me address the reasonable inference of recency, which Your Honor is talking about. Those are the two things that matter in this case, is the accessibility of the box and the recency of the fingerprint. Again, the Commonwealth's evidence does not permit that inference. There have to be facts in the record from which inferences can be drawn. The Commonwealth's fingerprint experts were not asked how to determine whether a fingerprint is recent. They weren't asked if they thought this fingerprint was recent or how old they thought this fingerprint was. They were asked, can it last a long time? And the answer was yes.
But isn't there some evidence that's not speculative that the fact that the box was used every day, every time he goes up to a toll booth, he reaches in, he takes money out of his box in his console, and he pays the toll. And the fact that of the prints that were recovered, a lot of them were smeared, and only two of them were recoverable, one of Mr. Duncan and one of Mr. Winslow. So isn't that some evidence of recency?
Yes, Your Honor, again, it is
because
not
if it had been a year old, it would have been smeared by daily usage, perhaps.
Perhaps, and that's an inference that is not permissible on the record, Your Honor, and that's what I'm saying. This case, everyone's like, well, why would his fingerprint be there? We're not there yet. It is not permissible to argue that the legible fingerprint is the most recent fingerprint. There is nothing in evidence to tell us that. The fingerprint expert said, you can't tell when a print is left. And then he said, it can last a long time depending on the surface and the exposure. it is entirely possible, and we don't know because the Commonwealth didn't ask, that that box sat in the console and no one ever had to touch it in order to take the money out. It is entirely possible that Duncan's print on that box is over a year old, is from when he put the box in the car. There is nothing in the evidence from which inferences can be drawn. The two facts about the recency of fingerprints in the evidence are you can't tell when a print is placed. That is unequivocal. The print itself is not enough, according to the fingerprint expert, regardless of the fact that it's legible. They knew there were two legible prints. They knew there were five cards. The Commonwealth didn't even ask them, is this a recent print? When the Commonwealth doesn't ask the question that's crucial to their case, we're not allowed to assume that the answer would be favorable to the Commonwealth. It's possible the Commonwealth didn't ask for a reason. But I ask you, you have
to... Well, the answer would be we can't tell.
That's right.
When you get a print, we can't tell. So the recency or not, if it is determinable, has to be determined from circumstantial evidence.
That's correct.
Is it a door to a grocery store that people enter every day? It's unlikely that a print would last a year in that situation.
Your Honor, and in that situation, the door is being touched all the time.
And it's cleaned periodically.
We don't know. We don't know about this box. And we don't know whether the print was on the back of the box. We don't know whether, as that box sat in the console, you had to put your print on the back of the box in order to open it or not. We don't even know if you had to open it. Maybe it was small enough it sat in the console open. We do not know. Nobody asked Mr. Duncan, did you wipe this off? Was it clean when you put it in the car? How often do you handle it? Do you have to touch it to open it? Nobody asked these questions. There is simply no evidence on these points.
Your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, I think still. May it please the Court, I'm Susan Baumgartner for the Commonwealth. The law is clear that a fingerprint combined with circumstances that reasonably exclude a hypothesis that it was left there at some time other than the time of the crime is sufficient for a fact finder's inference. The defendant, the person leaving the print, is the criminal agent. That's what we have here. And there's an interplay between mobility and accessibility that I think is very important, and it's from Ricks, which is that even if the box is a mobile item, the box could theoretically be picked up and moved. The fact that it did not move in over a year takes that out of the equation. It's not a mobile object just because it could be moved, because the evidence proved that it had not been moved. Similarly, the idea of accessibility, it's not enough that you can theoretically access the box. I leave my house unlocked sometimes. That doesn't mean the interior of my house is accessible to passersby. The defendant had no innocent access to the box. Therefore, his fingerprint on it was highly relevant. Now, I think what comes down here is this is largely a factual dispute. For instance, the evidence was not that the fingerprint could have lasted a long time. The question was, isn't it true that a fingerprint could last a long time? And the response was, well, that depends on the surface and the exposure. The evidence was that this box was exposed to fingerprints all the time. On the day of the crime, Mr. Duncan touched it at least three times. He said he used it to get tolls out in the morning, in the afternoon, and then the third time when he discovered the
fact. Can you clear up a factual question for me?
Sure.
Was this box, it was referred to being in the console. Some cars, a console has its own lid. Sometimes it doesn't. It's just sitting out free. Which one was this?
This had a closed lid that was kept closed. Mr. Duncan testified about this on page 61 of the appendix, where he was asked, could you see this box from outside the car? And he said, it's kept in a lidded console, and it's lidded itself, on page 61
of the appendix. So your argument that a valet did it, it meets with the response, what would a valet be doing in the console either?
Correct. A valet might have innocent access to the car itself,
but not to the console.
And therefore, the reasonable inference is that Mr. Winslow simply wouldn't have left it at a different time. There is a lot of evidence to suggest the inference of recency, as Justice Rausch was discussing. There were 5 prints on this box that Mr. Duncan used multiple times a day. Only 2 of them were capable of being read, were of value. And the evidence also suggested an inference that this was touched. First of all, that it had to be touched to open, because the evidence was that it was closed, and there was also evidence that all 5 prints were from the back of the box by the hinge. The print of Mr. Winslow's that was on it was his ring finger on his right hand, suggesting putting your hand on the lid, and his 4th finger touched the hinge as he lifted up the lid. So therefore, there's certainly evidence that strongly shows he opened that box. If that box is regularly being opened, there is also evidence that exposure affects the length of fingerprints. Exposure includes not just the elements, but who's touching it. If it's regularly being touched, that is exposure that decays fingerprints, that smudges fingerprints, and they're no longer of value. And therefore, it was reasonable for the court to decide there was recency. In short, the court followed a logical analysis. The crime occurred. There was no question that the crime occurred, that there was a fingerprint on the box, that the person who stole the money, who fished out $20 in coins from among foreign money, would have had to touch it, and that there was simply no reasonable explanation for why Winslow either would have had access to the box or would have had even access to the car. If there are no further questions?
I'm a little concerned by the no reasonable explanation of access. I think to a certain extent that's shifting the burden on the defendant to explain the presence of his prints when he has no burden.
I understand that concern. However, the court needs to make its decisions from the evidence. It can't make something out of thin air. And the evidence did show that that box had been inside the console for over a year. And there are laws that you can't go into someone else's car and start pawing through it. And certainly the same way as in Ricks, as in other cases involving, you know, Parrish or even Stevenson and Burham about items that are touched. Well, if there's no explanation, if there's no reasonable explanation that the court can think of, it's not burden shifting. It's merely that the court can't make up an explanation completely absent from the evidence. It would be different if...
Maybe my problem, not to be too picky, is with the use of the word explanation, because that would seem to have to emanate from the defendant as opposed to some reasonable hypothesis.
It might not be the best choice of words. If you have a case such as, you know, there are cases about checks and when a print would be left on a check that was generally accessible, the issue really seems to be focused on in the case law about whether or not it's accessible. And whether or not it was likely to be left there.
Counsel, I take it you agree with this comment from Avent, and let me read it to you. We also feel that the rule in McNeil does not compel the state to negative every conceivable possibility that an accused, shown to be at the scene of a crime by his fingerprint, was present other than at the time of the commission of the crime.
Correct. The issue is beyond a reasonable doubt, not beyond any doubt. I mean, I'm sure we could figure out some possibility of somehow, theoretically, someone, he could have been in the console, and perhaps that fingerprint could have lasted for 10 years or something like that.
Your point is it's not the commonwealth's burden to negative, to, first of all, make up or propose an explanation and then negative.
Correct. It's really impossible to prove that sort of negative.
Okay.
What is your response to counsel's point that the only thing the commonwealth proved is that at least a year is shorter than a long time?
Well, first of all, the evidence, the can it stay on for a long time was not agreed to by the fingerprint expert. The fingerprint expert, for lack of a better term, weaseled a little bit and said, well, it depends on the exposure and the surface. That's not agreeing with the statement that it could stay on for a long time. Also, a long time is particularly vague. A long time for fingerprints might be a month, it might be 6 months, it might be 10 years. So therefore, that's really not evidence of particular value in this case, because it's so vague about how long it could have. And it also has the follow-up, which is it depends on the surface, it depends on the exposure, and there's a great deal of evidence about the exposure, how there was regular exposure to fingerprint, or to other prints, and that's why there were three smudge prints and Mr. Duncan's print on the box. Does that answer your question?
Call the next case.
Thank you.